Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. I was perusing the New York Times Book Review's bestseller list earlier this week and found an interesting entry. A book from 2017 entered the nonfiction list for the first time. Just so happens I spoke with that book's author when The Color of Law first came out. Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow emeritus at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. In his book, Rothstein recounts a history of how federal, state, and local policies explicitly segregated cities and neighborhoods nationwide, not just in the South, but throughout the country, the Northeast, Northwest, and the Midwest. He punctures the notion that it was private interest, exclusionary covenants, real estate agents, or mortgage lenders working outside of the law, which helped create these segregated neighborhoods and residential areas. But in fact, it was government institutions for decades that didn't just ignore discriminatory policies, but it actually promoted them. This idea that it was individual preferences, socioeconomics, prejudice, or private institutions that led to segregation communities has been widespread. It's been often cited in the judicial system, even the Supreme Court. The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, lays out that history in stark detail through public housing, the Federal Housing Authority, local zoning and city development policies, which all had segregationist policies at their heart through much of the 20th century. I spoke with Rothstein in 2017 when the book first came out, and we repeat the conversation today on Studio Tulsa. Richard Rothstein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your new book, The Color of Law, starts with a phrase that you began to hear after racial unrest, after the police shootings in places like Ferguson and a number of uprisings surrounding police shootings in various locations around the country. And that term was de facto segregation for places like Ferguson, Missouri, and other places where there have been some shootings. And you said that phrase sort of stuck in your mind as you began to write The Color of Law, the idea that these places became segregated of themselves through no outside forces. Was that a central tenet in deciding to write this book, The Color of Law?
Yes. We have a national myth that the reason that we have residential segregation in every metropolitan area in this country is because of private prejudice, or perhaps because families choose to live with others of the same race, or perhaps because private businesses like real estate or banks discriminated and steered families to same race neighborhoods. And the Supreme Court and policymakers call that kind of accidental segregation a de facto segregation. But in fact, it's a myth. The segregation that we have in every metropolitan area was designed, enforced, and structured by the federal government with support from state and local governments. There were many policies that I describe in the book of the federal, state, and local governments to enforce segregation. The term that the court uses for this is de jure segregation, but the court and policymakers deny that de jure segregation exists, because if they admitted it, if we acknowledged, all of us, that residential segregation is the product of government action, we'd understand that it's unconstitutional, and we're obligated to remedy it. And so by failing to recognize how the federal government, with support from state and local governments, segregated the nation, we absolve ourselves of the responsibility for remedying it. And the result is, as you say, incidents like Ferguson and other places where we concentrated African Americans in same race neighborhoods, leading to those kinds of problems, as well as many other problems that we face in this country.
You mentioned the Supreme Court. That was another influence, was a 2007 decision, which the court said that certain school districts couldn't take racial composition into account in segregation or desegregation plans in the school districts because, in fact, the segregation was de facto. It was not a government action. And you said, I decided to take that ruling at its word and sort of make an argument for the opposite, that in fact it is de jure segregation. I guess that's the reason for the book, right?
Yes, that's when I started writing the book. The Supreme Court prohibited the school districts of Louisville and Seattle from implementing very token school integration plans because the court said, and both the liberal and conservative justices agreed with this, the court said that cities of Louisville and Seattle had segregated schools because they were located in segregated neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods were segregated without government action. And I knew very little about this history at the time, but I did remember reading about how in Louisville in the 1950s, when a black family bought a home without government help from a white family in a suburb of Louisville, the state of Kentucky arrested, prosecuted, convicted, and jailed the white seller for sedition. So I had an inkling that there was something more than private action involved in the enforcement of segregation. And as I did the research for the book, I found that it was not just isolated incidents like this, but a systematic policy of federal and state local governments to create residential segregation. And this history was once well known, but it's all been forgotten. Even that small incident that I mentioned of jailing a homeowner, a white homeowner, for selling to an African-American, that was not hidden. That was out in the open. It was well known that we had an official policy of maintaining racial segregation, but we've forgotten it. And as a result, we failed to remedy it.
Now, when we look at something like housing discrimination, I think if you ask somebody when the origins of when housing discrimination became illegal, you'd probably say sometime during the civil rights era. If you were really knowledgeable, you would say, well, the Fair Housing Act in 1968 might have done that. But actually, you write very quickly in the book that actually housing discrimination has been illegal since 1866, right after the Civil War. It's just never been enforced.
That's correct. Housing discrimination has been illegal since 1866. It's also unconstitutional for the federal government to enforce that discrimination as it does and has done throughout the last 150 years. But once that segregation was implemented, it takes on a life of its own. And we did adopt the Fair Housing Act in 1968, but the Fair Housing Act was inadequate to remedy the segregation that we created. For example, during the mid-20th century, the Federal Housing Administration subsidized mass production builders in every jurisdiction in this country, every large city in this country, to build suburbs for whites only. The Federal Housing Administration prohibited them from selling houses to African Americans. Perhaps the best known of these, one of the largest in New York, was Levittown. This was not a policy that was restricted to southern states. It was implemented primarily in the North, the West, and the Midwest. So in Levittown, for example, the federal government required that Levitt not sell homes to African Americans and required him further to put a clause in every deed of the home prohibiting homeowners from reselling to an African American. Well, the white working class families of returning war veterans who bought homes in these suburbs like Levittown or others throughout the country bought them at the time for less than $100,000 in today's terms. They were easily affordable for both white and black working class families, returning war veterans in particular, but only whites were permitted to buy them. Over the next couple of generations, those houses in these federally subsidized suburbs gained value so that they're now worth $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. The white families who bought those homes gained in the intervening couple of generations $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 in home equity. They use that to send their children to college. They use that for medical emergencies. They use that to finance their own retirements. They use that to take care of aged parents. African Americans who were prohibited from moving into the suburbs and required to remain renting apartments in cities gain none of that wealth. The result is that today, on average, African-American incomes are about 60% of white incomes, but African-American wealth is about 7% of white wealth, and that enormous disparity is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy. Well, we passed a Fair Housing Act in 1968 that said, in effect, okay, African-Americans, you're now permitted to move into these suburbs that we created as all-white communities. But it was an empty invitation because the homes are no longer affordable to working class, even middle class families who can't afford to move to homes that sell for $500,000. So unless we take much more aggressive action to remedy the policies that created this segregation, simply saying that for the future we're no longer going to practice segregation is not adequate to undo the damage that we've created.
And we have to remember, after World War II, when the FHA was starting to wholesale finance suburbs and the building of subdivisions and the like, there was an acute housing shortage. So there was no, you know, even under the rules of the day of through Plessy and Ferguson, at least as far as school, there was no separate but equal. There were no African-American. FHA was not financing houses for African-Americans at all.
That's correct. And the term we use for the refusal of the FHA to finance homes for African-Americans is frequently redlining. The term comes from the fact that in the 1930s, the federal government drew maps of every metropolitan area in the country and colored red neighborhoods where African-Americans lived and which would be ineligible for home finance. So you're absolutely correct. There was no financing, or very, very little. There were some token examples, but no financing to speak of housing for African-Americans, but adequate financing for the movement of white families out of urban areas into the newly developing suburbs. The entire suburbanization of this country was primarily financed in the mid-20th century on a racially exclusive basis by the federal government.
You begin your book with, you said, you know, you wanted to challenge this idea that the segregation that exists today is de facto rather than de jure. And you use a case example, said, okay, let's look at one of the most liberal communities in the country, the San Francisco Bay Area. And you use a case example of Richmond, California, of how government created segregated communities, even going back to, this goes back to about 1930s, really, and then the war years when Richmond became an important war production facility and needed African-American workers to work there. Can you maybe take us through that little case study?
Sure. Throughout the country, there was massive migration of not only African-Americans, but whites to work in defense industries during World War II. Richmond, California, was a center of shipbuilding for the war effort. At the beginning of the war, the total population of Richmond was about 15,000. Very few African-Americans in that city, maybe 200 who worked as domestic servants for white families. By the end of World War II, the massive migration of both black and white workers to Richmond to work in the shipbuilding industry lifted the population of that city to over 100,000. I don't know if you can imagine what it's like for a city to grow from 15,000 to 100,000 in only 4 years. Obviously, there was no housing for the workers, both either white or black, who migrated to Richmond. But unless the federal government could find housing for them, the shipbuilding would cease and the war effort would be impeded. So the federal government came into Richmond, as it did in centers of war production across the country, and built housing for war workers. But it built it on a segregated basis. So it built housing in Richmond for African-American workers along the railroad tracks in the industrial area, and it built housing for whites further inland in the residential areas, creating a segregated pattern in a city that had never known segregation before. And this created a situation where eventually Richmond became a black ghetto. And this happened all across the country. The great African-American novelist, the poet Langston Hughes, wrote in his autobiography how he grew up in a Cleveland neighborhood, which was integrated. He says that his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. Well, during the New Deal, the federal government came into that neighborhood, demolished the integrated housing, and built two separate public housing projects, one for blacks, one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation that had never before existed in that community. It's not that there wasn't some segregation in cities all across the country without the federal government's help, but without the federal government's action, it would have been much less powerful, and it would not have been reinforced and exacerbated, and we would have much more integration in our major cities today than, in fact, we do.
My guest today is Richard Rothstein, a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. His new book is titled The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard, when we think of public housing today, we think of it as a last resort in high poverty areas. We think of it as a home for people of low socioeconomic means and also for people of color who are of low socioeconomic. I was really astounded to read that when public housing first began, for the most part, it was created, again, for white, low socioeconomic workers, or even lower middle class workers, again, because of a housing shortage that was so acute in the 1930s, 1940s, and really even to the 1950s.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. Our image of public housing is historically inaccurate, our popular image. It was begun during the New Deal because of a massive housing shortage of families who lost their homes in the Depression, white families in particular, and also to provide jobs for construction workers to build that housing. Frequently, the housing that was built by the government wasn't subsidized because the families paid the full cost of rent, but they just had no housing in the private sector. Throughout the country, the federal government built middle-class housing, really up until the mid-1950s, early 1950s, when, because of the policies that I described before that were followed by the Federal Housing Administration to subsidize whites to move out of public housing as well as out of private housing in urban areas and into single-family homes in the suburbs, only then did the public housing become predominantly African American and predominantly for low-income families. Then public housing authorities began to subsidize them. They failed to upkeep them, to perform the necessary maintenance because the rents were no longer adequate to pay for the cost of housing because the families became so poor. Industries left the same cities that the white working class families were being subsidized to leave. So we turned public housing from a resource for lower middle class families for whom the private sector wasn't building housing into vertical slums that created the image that we have today. You know, in the early 1950s, perhaps one of the best known examples of the high rise towers of public housing is the Pruitt-Igoe Towers in St. Louis. Maybe you recall. There were widely publicized photos. Eventually, they became so dysfunctional and so rife with poverty and disinvestment and deterioration that the federal government dynamited them. But in the early 1950s, that project was built as two separate projects. The Pruitt Towers were for African Americans only. The Igoe Towers were for whites only. But within a few years after the project was built, the white Igoe Towers had large numbers of vacancies, and the black Pruitt Towers had long waiting lists. Solely because of the FHA policy to subsidize the tenants of the white project to move into single-family homes in the suburbs and to prohibit African-American residents of the Pruitt Towers from doing the same thing. Well, eventually the situation became so conspicuous, not only in St. Louis, but in every public housing agency in the country, that the exclusive white projects were opened up to African Americans. It became primarily a way to house low-income African Americans who became poorer and poorer as the jobs left the cities for the suburbs. And that's how we created the kind of public housing that we think is typical today. But it did not originally begin that way. That was not its intent. And it played a role, an important role, in segregating the country.
You also talk about local roles, some governmental, some non-governmental. Obviously, when fair housing laws changed to allow African Americans to move into what had been all white enclaves, you saw white flight from those areas oftentimes. But also local governments, in the name of urban renewal, in modernizing their city, would sometimes actually even exacerbate a lot of the housing issues for people of color in their community by dynamiting working neighborhoods in the name of progress for urban renewal or for interstate highway system. We certainly had that experience here in Tulsa with the 244 expressway going right through the middle of the Greenwood neighborhood.
Yes, this was a common phenomenon nationwide, and you say it was in the name of progress, but very frequently it was also in the name of segregation. public officials were much less embarrassed about openly stating their racial intent back in those days than they are today. And very frequently, interstate highways were built when they went through cities, either to separate a black from a white neighborhood, to make it more difficult for the black population to move across a racial boundary line into a white neighborhood, or to demolish an African-American neighborhood to move the population to a designated black area. In Chicago, perhaps one of the best-known examples nationwide, the Dan Ryan Expressway was built to separate black and white neighborhoods. The Federal Housing Administration recommended that highways be used as natural barriers to prevent integration.
Wow.
In cities like Miami, there was a city plan which designated a specific area for African-American residents, and the interstate highway that went through Miami was routed for the purpose of demolishing an African-American neighborhood to force the population to move to the area that had been designated as an African-American ghetto in the city plan. So this was commonplace around the country. As I say, it's all been forgotten now. We think that the segregation that resulted from the interstate highway system was all the unintended consequence of progress, as you say. But it wasn't that at all. It was very explicit, very open. It was well known at the time, and this history has all been forgotten.
Well, as we look forward, almost 50 years since the Federal Housing Act has at least reaffirmed that housing discrimination is illegal. I know there are people who are listening to this and saying, yes, this happened, but things have changed over the last 50 years. Do we still need to take remedies to address these wrongs that happened 60, 70, 80, 100 years ago?
Yes, we certainly do. It's undeniable. Of course, it's the case that the Fair Housing Act made it easier for African-Americans to move out of designated African-American neighborhoods. Some integration has resulted from the Fair Housing Act. It's certainly a positive step forward. It took a long time to enforce it. For the first 20 years of its existence, until 1988, there were no real enforcement mechanisms. But it's a step forward. But the housing from which African-Americans were excluded in the mid-20th century, that was low-cost housing at the time, single-family homes in all white suburbs that were affordable to working-class families in the mid-20th century, are now no longer affordable to African-Americans or to middle-class whites, for that matter. A few whites can afford to. Young people can't afford to buy homes, or single-family homes, the way their parents did, because the prices have risen so much in the suburbs that were affordable 50 or 60 years ago. So simply passing a law as the Fair Housing Act that says that from now on you can't discriminate does nothing to undo the economic effects of residential segregation that was imposed by the federal government. So we need much more aggressive policy than the Fair Housing Act to desegregate the metropolitan areas the government created.
And I guess I would also argue that today there's very, very little affordable new housing being created that would be even open to all. I mean, well, new construction is for generally high end. There's very little affordable housing being built in America today.
Well, that's correct. The same suburbs that were created as all-white enclaves by the federal government in the mid-20th century then adopted zoning ordinances that, as the housing prices rose in those suburbs and they became unaffordable to working-class families, lower-middle-class families, suburbs adopted zoning ordinances that prohibited, for example, the construction of single-family homes on modest lot sizes or required large setbacks so that many acres or several acres had to be purchased in order to build a home. All of these designed to keep low-income families out of the communities that once may have been low-income communities or moderate-income communities themselves. So this is one area that reform is desperately needed. Because of the federal unconstitutional policy of segregating these white-only suburbs, the exclusionary zoning ordinances that these suburbs subsequently adopted perpetuate the unconstitutional effects of federal policy, and they need to be reformed.
What are some of the other needed reforms that you outline in the book?
Well, as I say, one of them is a reform of the exclusionary zoning policies of suburbs to permit the construction of single-family homes on modest lot sizes or townhouses or apartments. Every community should have a mix of residences of families of different income rather than concentrating all the low-income families in single neighborhoods in urban areas. But for low-income families in particular, the federal government maintains several policies that reinforce segregation to this day. For example, many your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of the Section 8 housing voucher program, which mm-hmm. is a program that provides subsidies to low-income families so that they can rent apartments in the private market. But these subsidies are calculated on the average rent costs in a large area, metropolitan area. The subsidies are too little to enable a family to afford to rent an apartment in a middle-class area, and actually too much to for them to that they need to afford to rent an apartment in an already segregated neighborhood. So landlords in those neighborhoods exploit the program by charging more than the market requires. So the result is that the Section 8 voucher program winds up reinforcing segregation because the only place that the most Section 8 voucher holders can move is already segregated neighborhoods. That's an easy program to reform. We could shift the subsidies so that higher subsidies are granted to families who move into middle-class neighborhoods so they can afford to live in those neighborhoods, and lower subsidies are granted to families who choose to move into already segregated neighborhoods. We have another policy that the Treasury Department operates called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, which is a subsidy to developers to build projects, homes for low and moderate income families. And that also reinforces segregation because the developers typically use those tax credits to build projects in already segregated neighborhoods simply because land is cheaper there, because there's less community opposition, because they can put for rent signs in the front of the houses and the families can walk by and see them. But we could easily reform that program so that there are incentives to build projects once we reform the zoning laws in middle-class communities, to integrate those communities and to prevent the concentration of disadvantage in already segregated communities. So these reforms are possible, but we're not likely to pursue these kinds of reforms unless we understand that the residential segregation that we have is unconstitutional, it was created by explicit federal policy, and that we have an obligation to remedy it.
The name of the book is The Color of Law. Richard Rothstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Rothstein speaking with us back in 2017 when his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, first came out. Book entered the New York Times bestseller list just this past week. Rothstein is a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow emeritus at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.